Yeah. This session is part of the Jewish Journey Breakouts titled Reimagining Jewish. In the 20th century, Jewish institutions defined our community and our identity. In today's more digital world, many of us are guiding our own paths, finding alternate ways to community. Amid so much change, we need to ask ourselves, what are the essential roles of our organizations today in Jewish communal life? Even better, what can they be?
We're going to get the benefit of two sessions.
Yeah. What does it mean to build Jewish community in the 21st century in and outside of our traditional institutions? With us today are four leaders at the forefront of reimagining Jewish. Aliza Klein, the founding executive director of One Table, a startup redefining Shabbat dinner. Noted author and cultural commentator Abigail Pogrebin. Rabbi Dr. Elliot Cosgrove from the Park Avenue Synagogue in New York. And Ellie Confer, who has helped nurture the growing independent Minyan movement. Beth Cousins, who leads JFNA's Jewish Education Engagement Office, will moderate today's session. Beth?
Thank you, Steve. Thanks, everybody, so much for being here. It's really a thrill to see a full room. And what could be worse than getting the benefit of, you know, beautiful music that may or may not be coming from next door? So on paper, as you just heard, we are learning today from a pulpit rabbi, two entrepreneurs, and a Jewish journalist who is also currently the president of one of the largest synagogues in North America. In real life, they are, each of them, engaged deeply with tradition and with innovation, with institutions and with the conceptual ideas that drive our understanding of what Judaism is, what Judaism itself is. They are making Judaism work and Jewish life work in the 21st century, doing that thing that we, that ephemeral thing that we talk so much about. They're visionaries, thought leaders, and also serious practitioners. So a note about logistics before we begin. I just want to note the way that we're going to do Q&A. Most of you have an index card, or actually maybe only half of them have an index card, because counting is not actually my specialty. So in the beginning, if you have a question, please write it down, and there'll be moderators circling the room. And then toward the end, we'll do more formal Q&A with the microphones. But we'll start taking questions very quickly, actually, via the index cards. So it's not news to observe that the infrastructure of Jewish life that we've built in North America and globally also is mocked often as an alphabet soup, right? And perhaps it's interesting to realize that many or even most of these institutions were actually built about 100 years ago, 110 years ago, in the beginning of the 20th century, a radically different era, if we really stop and think about it. Then they were shaped throughout the 20th century by all of the things that shaped the 20th century, sort of the domination of institutions, of property, of buildings, of material culture. So the organizations that we've built, not just in America, not just in Jewish life, but in America broadly, were really suited for another era. So we've entered the 21st century with our 20th century institutions and our 20th century institutionally based structure. Lots of independent actors, siloed organizations, and Jewish life taking place in buildings. But life itself has begun to take place outside of those buildings in what I call, and I didn't make this up, the in-between spaces. Online, right? Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, etc. Coffee spaces, right? The sidelines of soccer games. Not the Kiwanis Club, not our traditional institutions, not our membership organizations. So we have Jews, we have human beings who don't match our institutions and don't match the way we live Jewish life. So that's the premise of the session. We're hoping to talk about that more and maybe even, like, not brainstorm some answers, but think about what our response might be as an institutional Jewish community. And I'm going to stop talking and turn to the people on my right. What do you think of what I just said? Thoughts, reactions. Aliza, I'll turn to you.
Yeah, here we go. Hi, everybody. Nice to see you here. I think that's the reality, and I think that's exciting. I think the idea is life is changing, and that we can't do things, we can't have our starting point be, oh, that's the way we used to do it. So for someone like me, that's totally energizing. That's not scary, it's not depressing, it's an opportunity for creativity. And one of the things that has happened to me in the past couple of years is that I have been introduced to design thinking, which is a sort of a problem-solving technique that was made famous by our friends in Silicon Valley. And the idea is that it's human-centered design. It's understanding what people need as opposed to what an organization needs, for example. Before bringing Shabbat to the masses, I worked on a mikveh. I helped build a mikveh in the Boston Jewish community called Mayim Chaim, and no one was asking for a mikveh. There were a handful of people. But a handful of people is not going to raise $2 million community and get people to reclaim this institute. But the question is, what were they needing? And so the idea is not to focus on designing what I, the institution, need, but asking people what they need and what they value. Turned out that people desperately needed, you might relate to this, a place to mark moments in our lives where we go through transition and there's no ritual for them, or want to reclaim a traditional moment with a ritual. So this week, for example, many of us have felt the need to connect with others in person and to have quiet time and to replenish our souls and to re-engage with a community, regardless, honestly, of where we started the week. And what's the Jewish way to do that? What are the connections? What are the rituals? And if you start with that emotional understanding, then you come up with opportunities for people to meet in their homes, in pools, in lakes, in the woods, wherever they are. And that, I think, just that inspires more and more opportunities and creativity. It also requires an insistence on removing the judgment that if it takes place there, it's less valid than if it took place there. Or if they said that, then it's not as good as if they said that. And if you let go of those two things, which for whatever reason I have no problem doing, then an opportunity like this is energizing. Elliot.
Thank you, Beth. It's great to be here. And I agree with your question, and I agree with what Aliza just said. So hopefully we'll get more controversial as the panel gets along. But I do think, right, historically it's true. The major arms of American Jewish life were all, it's strange, but it's all about 100 years ago. If you think about the ADL, JDC, the movement arms of the conservative movement, other movements, they were all established reflecting a certain moment in American Jewish history. And they were all established with the idea of protecting and sustaining and revitalizing Jewish life as it reconstituted itself here on American shores. There's absolutely no reason why we shouldn't think about reimagining what the present day and the future institutions and the landscape itself should be. I think it's not only an okay question to ask, I think it's a necessary question to ask, and I imagine we'll get into questions of how it can be done. But at the same time, right, I think, the most important institution of all, and it's somewhat cliched, but I'm staring out at the community and I'm thinking about this, is the human soul, the Jewish soul. And why do I bring this up? Because there's someone sitting here who was my Hebrew high school director. And without me being in a certain model of a Jewish educational institution run by a charismatic person who took me under his wing, in a very conventional circumstance, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing right now. And there's someone sitting over here who pulled me aside and expressed to me how a summer at Jewish summer camp was one of, I'm sure, of many turning points where we worked together on staff at a Jewish summer camp. And so just as we need to ask serious and maybe painful questions about institutional life, I don't think we can discount the power of placing Jewish professionals with souls that are being formed in camps, Hillels, Hebrew high schools, day schools, the youth group culture. I think it still has a place. We just need to reimagine and think of them anew.
Thank you, Beth. I'm reacting to both of your comments and thinking about the way in which both Aliza and Elliot are representing, I think, two ways in which the 21st century institutions are grappling with our 20th century institutions are grappling with our modern life. There's the new and the old, and how to sort of work with both of those. The new is there was no mikveh in Boston that was serving the population you're talking about. And so how could we fill that gap? That's a perfect space, not necessarily for an old institution, but for a startup. And indeed, you demonstrated how that worked. And then the synagogue that Elliot is running is an old institution that is revitalized by leadership. And I think that is basically the only way that you can get an old, you know, sort of pre-21st century institution to act in modern ways is by sort of, you know, jamming it through with the leadership that's sort of...
Careful, some of them are here.
and obviously, I'm sure it's not alone, but the point is that the structures are oftentimes working against you, and you have the leadership that's pushing that through despite the structure as opposed to with the structure. When you create it from scratch, the structure is with you. It's the flow. It's the thing that gives you the opportunity. When you're inheriting something that's decades or 100 years old, you might have to be pushing against that structure. And I think that as we all enter into, I don't know, the new world order, I don't know what you want to call it. I don't think actually we're operating by centuries anymore. We had 20th century, we had 21st century, whatever that was until Tuesday. And now we have a new era that may call for new kinds of engagement and institutions and leadership. And I actually think that we're all in some ways playing catch up. The last thing I'll say about this is, do you imagine your institution as a place that is heterogeneous or homogeneous? And in some ways, that's going to drive how well the 20th century model is working or not. Now, sometimes heterogeneity is what 20th century institutions was. We are one. These are sort of communal institutions. We all have a seat at the table. That's meaning that I don't necessarily agree with or connect to everything that you do, and that's what makes our beautiful, diverse landscape. And at the same time, maybe what's called for in the new institution is the bubble, this sort of step out, the more homogeneity in a positive way to say, I want to be around people that I connect to over a certain set of affinities, and the big box institution isn't going to do that for me. I'm not going to be energized by this kind of gathering. I'd be energized by the subgroup gathering that happens at 10 p.m. And that's really sort of my institutional locus. So that also is sort of being clear about whether we're aiming for homogeneity in a positive way or heterogeneity in a positive way also dictates where you want to go with the institutional structure.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here and see the full room. I would say that I'm holding both the big box and the restlessness in the same hands. I'm president of Central Synagogue for just 3 years. I'm in my second, feels like 40 years in the desert. But it's extremely meaningful for me. And one thing I have really learned in this role is seeing the profound investment that people have in reliability, in familiarity, in a sense of family having grown up somewhere. And that can't be underestimated, I think, in the Jewish soul. Is that sense of I come someplace which is home, which has been home to my family, or I'm making my new home, and that's a powerful thing. But we have an Asian American woman who is our senior rabbi, and we have two lesbians on the bima. I mean, that is where we are holding the old and the new. This is an over 100-year-old synagogue with tremendous tradition. We have 7,000 members now and a waiting list, believe it or not, of 300. So somehow the newness has not alienated these people who are so holding on to reliability and familiarity. And I say the waiting list not because it has anything to do with me. It's that I do believe that it shows us that we shouldn't abandon the idea that these structures can be vibrant in 2017-18. That said, just me independently in my Jewish journey, which Ellie and Elliot have been very much a part of, frankly, is that I'm sort of on this crazy quest to understand more and learn more in my later part of my life. And I'll just say briefly that some of you may know that I wrote a series for The Forward in 2014-15 called 18 Holidays, One Wandering Jew. And what I did was I took on the entire calendar and was just determined to understand every single ritual, every milestone deeply, the sourcing and obviously the kind of gestation, but also tell me why this is relevant today. And what I got to do, which I wish every Jew had the chance to do, and obviously some of you already have, is to move around in the Jewish world. I went to Slichot, started at Rabbi Cosgrove's at 10 o'clock at night, and then at midnight I went to Ellie's at Fort Tyron. And just that night of Slichot, first of all, I had never been in that service, admittedly, completely changed the way I went into Rosh Hashanah. And going to Tashlich at Central, and we go to the East River with our families, but then going to Lab Shul and seeing what they were doing, which was a tour of Hell's Kitchen where you ended up at the Intrepid, was a complete, two completely different rituals. And what I would say that I just hope we all explore is not just trashing what exists, but a cross-pollination of what exists. I feel in my travels that everyone, they say they want to break open, they say they want to collaborate, but at the end of the day, everyone stays in their silos. It, you know, they're pretty much comfortable with what they know. I've seen that at Central as well. But the benefit of saying, you know, it's very different to go to HIR in Riverdale and then to go to Romamu, but wow, are both, do both things feed you Jewishly? And are there opportunities to have more of that sharing than exists today?
So thank you. So Abby actually just asked us to hold a both and in our head. And I feel like this is very much a both and conversation, right? This isn't about moving away from our traditional institutions. It's about revitalizing our traditional institutions and creating something new. So now I want to ask us to hold a both and turn to the something new. So we just had a few comments on what our traditional institutions might look like and what we might get from them. What are the new institutions we need to create? What's the new infrastructure that we might need to build? And I say infrastructure with a small I, right? I'm talking about all kinds of infrastructure.
Oh.
Aliza, might you want to start?
I do. I started with the bricks and water, which is what we started with. And now I'm working in something that's totally different, and I'm excited by it, so that'll become clear in a second. But I was, just a couple of years ago, brought on, this is a total self-promotion and advertisement for the organization, I just realized, but I think it's legit and a real answer to your question, and probably what got me on the panel. So that's my caveat. A couple of senior philanthropists who we all know and recognize in the Jewish community wanted once again to infuse life into young adults, into millennials. There's a few of us in the room. I'm not one, but there's a few of you in the room, which is great. And the charge was go out and make Shabbat dinner a habit. That was the charge. And I think that's a funny name and has good and bad things about creating a habit in our lives. But the idea was rather than me trying to figure out what would work for me in my life and for this funder's life, what might actually be relevant to the lives of people with whom we wanted to engage.
In the space of Shabbat.
In the space of Shabbat dinner. So yeah, I know it's 25 hours, and we focus on the one and the one why, because very quickly we started realizing, well, everybody has a moment of transition between their work week or their school week and their weekend. Even those who are working 60 hours, there is some moment of pause of transition, and that is gold. What do people need in that moment? What would make their lives better in that moment? What are they doing naturally or intuitively? And how might we solve these? And so on, and start asking all of these questions and observing and finding people and sending people out to dinners. Everybody has to eat, and everybody needs to pause, and everybody needs to breathe, and people need to connect, and they have to put down their phones at a certain point, and they can't without help. Because there's too many options. How do I choose which one to do? I don't actually have a table. How am I going to host a dinner? That's what my mom did or my grandmother, but that's not where I am in my life. I work until 8 p.m. Like the barriers become more and more clear, let alone just the self-confidence. So we started rethinking not about creating a box of stuff that might make it a Shabbat dinner more palatable. Here's a cup. You probably have your own cup. Here's some candles. Not hard to get. But what was harder to get was how do I find the time? How do I connect with other people? And what became very clear is that we were not creating stuff. And we were not creating a place. We were not creating a destination. What we ended up creating was really a network using technology so that people could do it for themselves. So ultimately, what we have is something that looks a little like Airbnb. So I'm hoping most of you are probably familiar, right? It's a platform that allows any of us to open up our homes and invite strangers to stay there for money. You're there or not. And the idea was, what if you do this for meals? And there was a whole world of online resources, not for online interaction. This is not about a Facebook relationship. This is about going online for the sake of going offline. So it doesn't look like a building. It doesn't look like a place or a meeting. It looks kind of like a bunch of squares online. I'm happy to show you. But it changes things so that people can then make those communities in their living rooms, on their roofs, in the public park, on the beach, wherever they happen to be. Sort of teaching that Jewish ritual, and this one in particular, is portable. And it goes where you go. So the other acknowledgement is that for this stage of life, the likelihood of walking into even an extraordinary synagogue like the ones on my right and left is slim. So if we acknowledge that, that again allows us, gives us permission to then figure out where people are going and provide that infrastructure instead.
Thanks. Other comments about sort of the new infrastructure?
So I'm going to talk about synagogues because that's what I know best. I think, pardon me?
Oh, onetable.org.
Thank you for asking.
So if there's been, every generation has recreated synagogues. This was the innovation of, or the observation of Mordechai Kaplan when he reconstructed synagogue life here in America. And the question is that model still successful? If there is sort of a trope that I think is successful for, look, first of all, the Upper East Side is representative of absolutely nothing. So however nice it is for me to talk about my membership and Abby to talk about her membership, if we've learned anything, right, that ain't America. And so I think that's really important, A, just to name here and now in intellectual honesty. That said, the ethic, I think, of what makes for a successful synagogue, in addition to cultivating new leadership and partnering with outside organizations and being able to think outside of the box, is recognizing that for any sort of synagogue to be successful, it has to recognize the pivot of the American Jewish soul, right? On the one hand, and the people who understand this best are Chabad. You have to present yourself as an authentic expression of American, of Jewish life, period, whether it's Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, but it's also non-judgmental, right? It's we will meet you where you are, but there's also something aspirational that we're going to take you somewhere that you didn't think that was possible. It has to be with great sophistication, but it also has to be something that recognizes the Hebrew term is a tinok shenishba, that American Jewry is the ones just walking in the door are not a literate, prayer-ready community. And so on the one hand, woe to the person who's going to talk down to the most educated Jewish community, perhaps of history, and yet you have to recognize the deficiencies of, you know, I'd say a typical American Jewish education. It has to be, on the one hand, inclusive. The Jewish family is changing. It has to embrace the Jew and the non-Jew and all the other different stripes and types of people who walk into a synagogue. But there is still a calling card of peoplehood that I think draws someone into a synagogue structure. I think there needs to be an aspect of excellence, certainly on the Upper East Side, whether it's your gym, your restaurant, or your therapist. People expect excellence from everywhere, but I think people from their Jewish life want a certain do-it-yourself, DIY aspect, you know, like one to, so these are all sort of on a continuum, and you have to embrace both. At least my experience has been in a synagogue life, to meet people where they are, but also to build a vibrant, cohesive community.
So I just want to be really clear. That was a phenomenal list of characteristics that we might say are actually descriptive of 21st century life, right? And you said they apply to the synagogue, but of course they apply in general to this infrastructure that we're building. Vision, move, not just vision, but helping people move towards something together. Authenticity, inclusivity, right? The excellence, the tremendous list that you just gave us describes, I think, a lot of our successful prayer communities, whether they're in synagogues or not, and a lot of our successful projects in general.
If I could just jump
please,
in,
Ellie.
Building on the Chabad point, I think when I'm thinking about the institutional structures that were not early 20th century, but late 20th century, what comes to mind for me is Chabad and really the explosion of Chabad, which happened in late 20th century, and Birthright. When you think about both of those as institutional models, just think about how they're so different from federation or synagogues, generally, or those earlier institutional models that we were presented with. Chabad has a center. You can go visit it. But it has a building center, but it also has a spiritual leader center. Maybe alive, maybe not. But the point is, somebody was driving that bus, and it was a one singular character who had a vision for Jewish life and who raised up thousands and thousands of students. But even though it has a center, it is, of course, also DIY, and each Chabad is itself its own sort of mini flower of blooming, and that's why it's been able to proliferate so quickly. You think about even just like camps, like movement camps. It's like, with great hand-wringing, we'll launch another camp, like one per decade, but it's like Chabad is popping out the centers, like dozens and hundreds per decade. Because they have this center and because they trained an army of people who were able to do that. And for Birthright, what you have at the center of Birthright actually is not the philanthropists or even the educators. What's at the center of Birthright? It's Israel. That's what it is. It is an inspirational place where you can argue with this or not. Is this the right use of Israel or not? You have it as a 10-day experience where people come back changed because of their interaction with the spiritual and sort of inspirational center. So I think what you're looking for is something where there is an inspirational center that's driving it. Now, I think you could do that in an old-fashioned way where there is one Rebbe who's in charge, or Israel, which is sort of the like geographic Rebbe, as it were, for the non-religious, whatever, everyone sort of cut that. But I think really what I would like to sort of explore as the future model of the institution would be, what would it look like to have the inspiration actually decentralized in a way that has multiple possibilities of people taking up that mantle? Or to put it another way, what if the description that Eliot described of American Jewish education was completely flipped? That is to say, what if instead of Jews being only literate and the most educated and the most college-going sort of minority in America and the richest, right? What if that also applied to Jewish knowledge? How would our institutions look differently if you were sort of populated by that army of people? And so then I think the question that we really have before us is, in taking a step back and saying, instead of what's the institutional structure that we're trying to build, it's who is the population that might play out that institutional structure? And really, education there is the driver to get that. Are we willing to make the investments in the deep education that goes beyond the platitudes and beyond the sort of thin offering that's often put out there? That really, I think, is the pre-challenge to whether we're going to have an institutional response to our modern age.
I would just, you're coming off of that, and I think that it's important for me to clarify. When I say that Central is modern in the sense of who's on the Bima, it's very traditional in terms of the experience of worship there. And there's a real resistance to change there. And so as vibrant as we are, I think we're also kind of very much the old model. If you walk into that sanctuary, it's not newfangled particularly. There are innovations, but you almost don't feel them. And even though I'm a huge supporter and feel spiritual there, I see how hard it is to move that ship. There's tremendous resistance when any kind of new idea is really introduced because people are really invested in what they know. So I think we have to be honest today about the barriers, maybe more honest than we've been. One of them is the anxiety of ignorance that you were talking about. Being at the Shabbat table and having those prayers go rapid fire, I've been sitting there where they're just going faster than I can keep up. So I kind of feel like I've gotten to a certain place, and then people are still beyond me. So I might not come back to that table comfortably, and that's just a metaphor for what I think a lot of educated Jews, at least that I'm running with, are feeling. Like, don't make me feel like I'm the dumb person in that service or at the table, or frankly, in anything that has to do, we're not really talking about the structure of our rituals involve prayer. Maybe some of these institutions or these kind of new ideas are abandoning prayer, but I know, especially from Ellie, who has pushed back at me and said, if you don't understand something, maybe prayer is not a cognitive experience, Abby. Maybe you need to come at it differently. That, to me, is a challenging conversation that a lot of Jews are just not having because they've just decided prayer doesn't do it for them. They've decided liturgy is, page after page of dead language. And so to the education point, I know I'm a little bit all over the map, but I would just say, we also need our leaders to challenge us, the congregant or the member or whatever, when we're signing up to say, just don't necessarily be so comfortable with where you've landed. Without making us feel bad about it, to sort of challenge us that there's more to be had. Because that certainly is what happened to me. It obviously takes the right teachers. It takes people who don't make you feel stupid, make you feel invited. But I also think that those of us who have an education, who feel, it works when we feel challenged. When someone says, I think there's more here than you've actually decided there is. So I would just say in the new models, I hope there's that pushback from the people that we have invested our leadership in.
That was beautiful. And I want to riff off of that to ask everyone about something about the experience of being Jewish today. But before I do that, I just want to encourage the index card situation. So if people have questions, please write them down. And Jamie and Robin, I'm not sure who's in the room, if you guys can float and collect index cards, that would be great. Pass them on up. We'll start answering questions. So I want to riff off, Abby, what you just said, and also, Aliza, as you were talking, I was thinking a lot about another thing. You know, you've created a technological platform, a virtual platform, a virtual system for organizing Shabbat dinner. You've also created an atmosphere of permission, right?
Yeah.
And so I want to ask you to talk more about that, and I want to ask everybody to talk more about, as I said, sort of loosely the experience of being Jewish today, but what I really mean is, what's the conversation you would have with, like, you know, Jane, American Jew, or Plony, American Jew, about North American Jew, about what you hope their Jewish experience would actually be, and what kinds of, this isn't going to come out right, but what kinds of assumptions would you want to help them change about the way they think Jewish life should be and what their Jewish life actually could be? Aliza, you look like
I'm always ready. Okay, so, I am an emotion-first kind of person, and that drives me to be ritual-driven before, I could get in trouble here, but before education. So there are two camps, at least. And we've been on this panel before, Ali and I, so that's good. I think there's a fundamental agreement, and then we go in different ways. I think the should you actually choose to walk into a place or enter a place if you don't walk in some other way, then how do you feel immediately? How is the whole experience designed? Whose needs is the host? Who is the host? Should be clear. And how is that host taking care of you? And whether you are in a museum or in a school or in a mikveh or in someone's home or in a synagogue or in a JCC, you can fill in the blank. What does it feel like? And do you know what it feels like? How do you know what it feels like? Can you put yourself in those shoes? That is, I feel like, my whole life's work right there, is figuring out how do I have as much empathy as humanly possible as to how it feels when I enter, assuming I'm already willing to enter, right? And I can feel it, like, in my chest and up to my throat, because I'm guessing I'm not the only one who has entered a space sometimes and not felt comfortable or welcome, right? Abby referenced being someone's home. You're like, I missed it, right? What's our job here? So I think the one of the things that we have felt the need to do, right, is this granting of permission that Beth was mentioning, meaning there is no Shabbat police. This is a home-based ritual, right? You set the time. It really doesn't matter to me what time you light Shabbat candles, what you say, or really if, right? What matters to me is that you find that there is a moment where I can pause and my wealth and well of Jewish tradition helps me lead a full life and create with people whom I love, and that to me is the essence. And from that comes curiosity and opportunity to learn and grow and connect. But the fundamental need of feeling that sense of belonging and safety and security to me drives everything. So that's where I start. Ellie.
Can I jump off on that? I'm actually, what you're making me think of is the following experience that some of us have had. Think about the time, think about your own Jewish journey and the reason why you're in this room in the first place. Can you trace that back to an institution or to a person? Now, I want to sort of give you two options. Assuming you trace it back to a person, I want to give you two options. One is playing out what Aliza's talking about, and the other is sort of on the person-based side, which you also are talking about. But can you overcome the barrier of entry, and can you make a personal connection? So let's think about the barrier of entry for one second. You know, Shul's got it into their head that, we have to be places that are welcoming and greeting. right? So you don't want people to, because how often do you, like, I go to, you know, to a synagogue and it's like, what's the main experience of the synagogue? It's either a locked door that says, you know, use the side door. If you're lucky, there's a side, usually just locked door. Or, right, who do you meet on Rosh Hashanah? Who's the first person you see?
Security
guard, right? So, okay, so you have the, you know, and that's obviously not all synagogues. The synagogues are reacting to that already. But so let's say you have the best case scenario. Somebody is welcoming you at the door and you have the greeter. But is the greeter actually, do they know you? Are they going to, like, connect to you? Or are they going to smile at you and give you a book, right? And maybe tell you what page it's on. So you can sort of play that sort of well or medium. That's, you know, it's better than the locked door. It's not exactly the same as somebody who's sitting with you and guiding you through the whole service. I'm not sure you could do that. And then there's the other side of, okay, well, what do you take? Let's say you made it in. Now, who are you connecting to? Is it the rabbi gave an amazing sermon, and that's what I'm taking back? And therefore, whether the rabbi gives an amazing sermon next week is determinative of whether I'm going to stick with it. And if they don't, then I'm sort of out. Or is it, this person invited me for a Shabbat meal, right? Now, if you think about those two models, once you're already inside, if those two models, are you connecting with the central leadership up front, who actually probably has the best chance of being the one who's going to inspire you because they were actually hired to do that? Or is it somebody who is going to be sort of sitting next to you and says, oh, welcome, would you like to come to my place for lunch in a sort of non-awkward way? Right? And that's much more distributed in a way that sort of invites you in that anybody could do. And you could actually, you probably won't see yourself as being the rabbi giving the sermon next week, but you might be see yourself as, oh, a year later, I'm going to invite this person to lunch because that's how I got drawn into the community. But I think whichever way you cut it, I think what Aliza's talking about, what I'm affirming is the way in which we connect to institutions is through the people and the guides. And the only way that we're going to have any chance in any institutional structure is to allow the human connection to really flourish. And the more we stack on one person, then the more your chips are on that square. But if you're able to sort of distribute it in some way that goes beyond that, then there might be more opportunities for connection that go beyond the all chips on one square.
Just taking us back to the question. The question was, Abby, sort of where you ended. What conversation would you have with North American Jews to help them experience Jewishness, their Jewishness or Jewish life differently? Maybe in a new way. Maybe overturning their assumptions. Do you guys want to build on that at all? Or
no, I mean, I just repeat what Ellie said. So he said it better. But that's never stopped a rabbi from saying something.
So, by the way, I'm also a rabbi. Just wanted to put that out there.
That's not just rabbi.
Like, I think there was a nice line in Safran Foer's new book about Jews being so interested in Jewish continuity, but they just need to be Jewish, right? I mean, and stop worrying about the Jewish future and worry about their own Jewish practice. Now, that's somewhat, you know, so as a rabbi, that's of course what I'm going to say, but I think, right, the idea of just do it and just live Jewishly and have talented Jewish professionals who are willing to work outside of the four walls of the conventional Jewish institutional life to put the tools into searching Jews' hands. I think, you know, some of the most exciting things that are happening are partnerships between the steamships and the startups of the American Jewish world. And I think that... I know for me, and as Ellie said, for probably many people in this room, it all comes down to that one person who's able to nudge you along the way, that you can trace your Jewish journey. It's an incredibly powerful thought.
I mean, I would just add that a little bit different from what Aliza was saying, I do come at it as the education leads me to the emotion, and I feel like that is something that hasn't fully been explored. It's not that we don't have a lot of people trying education. I think the approach to education has been, frankly, more traditional, boring than it should be or could be. I don't think people have thought enough about how to make our tradition and texts so vital, so vibrant, so, frankly, relevant to your life that it's not a mushy thing. It's actually so additive that you think, I actually need this in my life, which is, frankly, the bar that's, I think, required, because we all can meditate and go to a lot of different things that enrich us, and I'm not denigrating any of them. But that idea of making the case for Judaism, which I know is not the way we should approach it, like we're selling it, but frankly, I have had now enough people who made the case for me that it became a priority in my life. And I think that that has been missing from a lot of the Jews I know. And part of it, I would say, I would challenge to answer your question, is I would say to the North American doubter or the half in, half out, find your teachers. They're not necessarily always rabbis, but almost bring your teachers to you, or you go to the teacher. I think that because people assume the barrier is the end, they don't get through it. And so they're not going to walk into, you know, a Simchat Torah celebration and dance with the Torah. It's just, that's a barrier too far, bridge too far. And if I wasn't a reporter in that framework, I'm not sure I could have let loose myself. But frankly, what happens to you when you do it is that you end up in a different place. Mm-hmm. And I would just end with, you know, Ellie was one of two teachers. He and Shai taught an Exodus class in my living room for a number of years. And granted, we came to them and asked if they would teach us. There was something, though, about taking it out of the building, as you say, and maybe the wine helped a bit. I would just encourage people to do that. Start small, find a teacher, do some tzedakah for that institution, but take it out of the institution.
Beth, I just want to stir the pot for a second, if I may, and maybe I'll never be invited back. But as I was walking by here, I forgot, because the email was buried deep into my in my inbox about which panel I was actually on. Was I on the Jewish leadership panel, or was I on the reimagining Judaism panel? And I honestly didn't know, and someone directed my way, but as I'm sitting here, I'm real, like, guys, the point of leadership is to reimagine, right? I don't know why it should be self-evident that that's a thing. And I think one of the questions that, if it's not going to be asked, it needs to be asked, so I'm going to be obnoxious and ask it, is the ability of the JFNAs, the alphabet soup of the Jewish world, to reimagine itself. Because I think so many, often we sort of, right, in the synagogue world, we shrei gvalt that a synagogue's closing, mm-hmm. but not realizing that that process is actually part of the natural organic ebb and flow, that Jews are leaving a certain part of Long Island and moving into Brooklyn, and the synagogue world needs to be able to pivot on that, or when we see processes that are duplicative. I was just in Hungary on a synagogue trip, and there's a Jewish agency institution, and there is a JDC institution, both committed to revitalizing Jewish life right there within a few square blocks of each other. And I'm sitting there thinking, like when I was in Ethiopia, and there were JDC fellows, and there was a Project 10 fellows of the Jewish agency, and they don't talk to each other. But it's my, I give to Federation, right? It's my Federation dollar that's being split like that. So I'm wondering, how willing is the umbrella of organized Jewish life to cycle out models that have run their course, to identify duplication and stare it in the eye? And I mean, these are really important questions.
If I could underscore that just with JFNA specifically around the new political world that we're living in, I think there is a possible moment where we have to reimagine what is the proper response to the election that happened on Tuesday. And it might not be the normal response that you would expect from Federation, which is managing a set of wide-ranging relationships. Maybe what it calls for in this moment is to say, there is some significant, regardless of politics, there is some significant problematic behavior and anti-Semitic bubbling up that we need to call out, because that is our new role. We are not going to have the old normal letter that we're normally going to send. We're actually going to do something different now, because we're living in a new world, and it's time for somebody to step up and do that. You can tell me it's not JFNA.
So clearly I'm going to jump in right now. I'm going to respond to what Ellie just said, and then I'm going to take us back to the larger topic of the panel. If you have an opinion about that, each federation has, not each federation, but most federations, and within the groupings, right, small, intermediate, large, intermediate, large, each grouping has representatives to the JFNA board, and you create JFNA. If you have an opinion about what Ellie just said, share it with your board president, your exec,
your representative to the JFNA board. We are JFNA. And I think, you know, this is a whole other panel right here. And you know, maybe I'll get in trouble, but I think it needs to be talked about, just maybe not here, for complicated reasons. Regarding what Elliot just said, I actually have the same response, right? And this is, I was thinking about just saying, okay, let me pause there because I want to end there. But let me say it now and then turn to some of the questions. Again, we are the federation system. And the reason we're having this conversation here is because our hope, of course, is that each of us takes this reimagining back to our communities and helps to reimagine everything around us and also the federation and also JFNA and also the larger system. And there's no question that, you know, I usually, in the shorthand in our own department, call it mergers and acquisitions, which is not really fair at all. But there's no question that new collaborations, and not just new collaborations, but actually a new collaboration that can then reimagine its job, right? Because even when if you consolidate two synagogue religious schools, for example, there shouldn't only be a consolidation that happens. There should be a reimagining of then what is the function of that new operation in the geographic space or in the virtual space that it's in to work with as many Jews and the non-Jews who love them in the space to help as much Jewishness thrive as possible. So amen to like, this is, yes, yes, yes. This is our job. So there's a bunch of really great questions here, and I'll dance among them. One of the ones that takes fewer words to say is, can you guys talk about this outside of Manhattan or outside of New York? Yeah. What is this? What advice, guidance, comments?
Let me speak to Brooklyn. I'm joking.
My bona fides include growing up in Colorado Springs, Colorado, and then Monroe, Louisiana. Thank you very much. And now, been on the East Coast for my adulthood. But, it looks different in different communities, and that requires paying attention to what people are looking for and what language they use and what expressions are appropriate and what resources are relevant and doing research to find that out. This is my first time working in a national organization that way. And so when we communicate with our hosts in the Bay Area, it's different than those in Denver and those in Chicago and those in Louisville and those in New York. One of the things that's interesting about asking people what is valuable to them is that you'll get different answers depending on where you are. And again, honoring that. I'm fascinated by what the pictures look like differently, the titles of dinners, and like it's the same fundamental ritual but happening in different places, and how people are coming to it. One of the most interesting indicators for me so far, as one table continues to grow, there are three privacy settings that a host can put. She can choose that it should be totally private. These are people that I know, I'm maybe hosting for the first time, and I just want to invite friends and maybe a friend of a friend. Then there's another opportunity, which is called host approval, which means you can put it on and anybody can request a seat, but I, the host, get to say yes or no. So I can decide, you know what, this person just dated that person and I don't think that's a great setup, for example, or just to protect. And the third is the sort of traditional Jewish community, first come, first serve, right, all open. And there is, of course, merit to that and some challenges with that. And one of the things that we've seen very quickly is dinners taking place outside of New York and Los Angeles and Chicago have more open dinners, right? Mm-hmm. The need for community is strong everywhere. The openness maybe towards welcoming in others and that need to be invited to others may be stronger in other communities, which is great. And the question is, how do we build on that? The movements, particularly among the population that we're focusing on, specifically the sort of post-college pre-family, word of mouth is the most valuable connection ever. That might mean they heard it, they saw it on their friends' Instagram feed, or it might mean that they were invited by a friend or that they heard about it as they were learning. But that person-to-person communication happens much more commonly and much more freely without, it's more porous. So I think the it's the same general concept, but in terms of paying attention and also just assuming that there aren't going to be those massive numbers, which actually I think makes the scale of allowing and empowering small groups to feel just as valid as a larger one, and even better and more maybe more practical opportunity.
The things that I said about inclusive and aspirational and otherwise, look, I'm a big city kid. I grew up in LA, I've been in Chicago, and now I'm in New York. So those are my points of reference. But there's no price tag on that, right? To have Jewish leadership be aspirational, inclusive, devotional, intellectually honest and open, right? These are not values that are big city, small city values. I just add that the other non-geographic contingent value is, and I'm hopefully this resonates with the room, is professional lay partnership. I've been blessed in our community that the vision of the community is done respecting what lay leaders bring to the table and respecting what Jewish professionals bring to the table. If you don't have that, and even on the Upper East Side, you're dead in the water. And I have to believe it's the same in smaller communities.
Yeah. So riffing off of a couple of things, I want to emphasize, because one of the questions about non-New York life and really about smaller communities is how can Jewish life be sustained in small towns when there's not enough people interested in making a minyan or a synagogue? So I wanted to say very specifically what I heard is that. Perhaps this always should have been true, perhaps it always was true, but in systems like the Federation system, we're very good at saying, tell us the answer, right? And there is no the answer for any community. The answer is, this is actually Talmudic, go and see what the people are doing, right? Get a group together or one-on-one, talk with people about who they are and what they're looking for in their life. There's a way to create Jewish life around that. It's an art, it's not a science, it's complicated, but it's doable, and actually that's what my department is here for. So feel free to call me. But the bottom line is it starts with the people. The answer I hope it's Jewish community, but it can't be a minion or a thing, because it might not be right for your community, Abby.
And I would just say that my perspective, I've been to, I think, almost every federation around the country and every JCC. I've been honored to be invited there. And I'm always struck by how non-New York it is, in the sense that it's a given that this was the hub. This was the hub, the family hub, the social hub. It was a place they went on weekends, much more than the New York City kids I grew up with, where you sort of had the banquet and you just were Jewish. Being Jewish was in the water. You didn't really have to do anything about it. In these communities, it was inspiring to me that the sort of the cohesion was a given. But I would say it wasn't so much prayer-based, education-based. I'm saying this as a generalization, and I'm granted I was going to luncheons and dinners, but what was incredibly powerful was, a mother taking her child or taking her mother, generations upon generations of coming to this luncheon or going to this JCC event, and that can't be underestimated, I think, as a way in. That people want to be with each other around a Jewish kind of event or a Jewish kind of cohesion glue. That should be part of this. I don't think we should disregard it, even though I thought it was powerful to have 15 people in my living room. There's something about being with 200 people in a ballroom and saying, we've come every year.
Yes. And I think the key word that you said, and that is completely relevant in any size community, is what's the number one reason people show up at things? Because they were invited. Because someone came over and said, come with me. Right? Like, that's it. That is it.
But I think that the part of the reason that an honest truth about big city and small city is that the advantage of big city over small city is, to the extent, and I'm from Providence, Rhode Island, to hate New York, but the main thing that it has an advantage is it can attract excellent people because of the larger infrastructure that's there. If there's a small city, if you attract an excellent leader, excellent federation leader, or a synagogue leader, then you will actually have a fantastic community that's led by the leader, because it's actually small enough that you can make that difference. I think actually structurally the challenge, this goes back to the JFNA challenge, is that it's possible that schools and synagogues can be transformed by a singular excellent leader, which maybe a big city has an advantage on a small city, although if it happens in a small city, it can work. But national organizations, it's possible that the structure may just swallow an excellent leader. Like, it may just be that national organizations, even with excellent A-plus level leadership, will not be able to do their job because it's just structurally impossible. Not like a synagogue and not like a school.
Cool, we'll hope. We're sort of at time. So let me pull some of the themes out of these comments and then ask each of you for any closing comments that you want to share. So this I actually need to read because it can't be summarized. I and other young families have welcomed many into our homes, schools, and events. But once newcomers are inside, I feel paralyzed with the fear of talking openly about being Jewish. How do we translate action into dialogue? There's a question that I interpret as essentially being about the diffusion of Jewish life. So when Jewish life is diffused, is there something that's lost when we, you know, are we losing essentially the good of our centralized institutions? And is there something that's inherently good about that centralization? And there's a question essentially about how do we, and we've been trying to do this for so long and we're still not there, how do we really help non-Jews feel welcome without saying to them, but being Jewish is better? Right? That's my language, if the person who wrote the question didn't like it. Closing thoughts about this,
Fred? I'll just add one thing that I did this year on the High Holidays that if I did nothing else, this got more traction than anything. Read David Gregory's book on How's Your Faith. In there, he cites a prayer that was said, I think, in a D.C. school. Rabbi Zeldin, is he here? He's a D.C. Suburban rabbi that embraced all of the non-Jewish members of our Jewish community. And I will tell you, there were tears. There were more emails about that 30 seconds than, you know, anything else the rabbi and Cantor did over the holidays. And they felt and knew that they have a place in our community.
Closing comments about these questions in general.
Don't assume you know how someone else is feeling. A lot of communities are finding that they put on name tags and they thought, good, now we're welcoming. And then they interview, then they find out people are not feeling welcome. So I would, don't give up. Ask.
Be in relationship and
ask,
have a conversation.
Yeah, how are you feeling? I noticed you didn't show up. What would you do instead? How come? What would it take to bring you back? It won't hurt you to ask, and you may come up with an insight that then changes. I think it's a very significant and real issue. And I think a lot of us are naming. I think the language is wrong. It's not non-Jew. I'm not a non-Black person. I'm not a non-Christian. I'm not non-Orthodox. I'm not non-anything. Like, that's not how I identify myself. So ask someone how she or he identifies themselves. And in particular with young adults, where intersectional is the language that we're using, right? I am this, and I am this, and I am this, and I am this. Ask someone to explain who they are and what their various sides of their personality are, because they might then find a better space in. And at minimum, you just made them feel important by asking them about themselves. So that doesn't hurt at all. It takes chutzpah to ask. It takes heart to look at people in the eye. This is not something we do a lot in America. It's hard to invite someone over for dinner. I'm happy to help. But I think that's what it's going to take.
I'll just end by saying, you are the leaders who are going to build these institutions, whether you like it or not. And the leaders are only as good as how inspired they are. So what are you doing to inspire yourself? And I hope that we can have that conversation.
I want to take the closing word by doing a commercial. Aliza made fun of herself, but you know, when she said, well, I'm just going to do a commercial for One Table, but we like commercials. We like Jewish resources. We like Jewish initiatives. So Abby just wrote a book. I can't remember the name.
My Jewish Year.
My Jewish Year. And you should Google her Forward series, which you can find. OneTable.org. Elliot's
My daughter's
sermons.
On YouTube. If you've seen the Hamilton YouTube Adon Olam.
Yeah, that's your mom!
That's my daughter.
Zoe!
That's awesome.
noticed that. I was going to say you should read Eliot's sermons are weekly on the Park Synagogue website. Eliot has a book about empowered Judaism, about Minyanim, and Machon Hadar has a fabulous program for text learning that's available to all of us, actually. So go team.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Beth.
Okay, I'm a fan.